Hi, this is Mark Lowry, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. On today's broadcast, Keith Brownell hosts a panel discussion with Ted Schroeder of Empower Missouri and Edna Hardin of Missouri Cure about their meeting with Ann Preseith, the new Director of Correction for the state of Missouri. Then Allie Catherine Bush talks with Michael Liamata, the new Director of Footprints Incorporated, about their work with homeless veterans and folks with addiction. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 Drug War news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Keith and his guests.
Good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. As you heard today, our guest will be Mr. Ted Schroeder of Empower Missouri and Ms. Edna Hardin of Missouri Cure. We have Mr. Schroeder here in the studio with us, and we'll be having a conversation with Ms. Hardin by way of telephone, I believe. Is she on the line?
I am online.
Okay.
Good morning, Edna.
Good morning.
Hi, Ted. How you doing?
I'm good.
By the way, I go by Hetty now.
All right.
Yes, I thought so.
Yeah. We'll be referring to you as Hetty then.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess what I normally do is I would like to ask the guests to just give our listening audience a little bit of information about yourself. And I, Ted, since you're here in the studio, I guess we'll start with you.
I first began to interface with the Missouri Department of Corrections 40 years ago when I became a pastor in the black community of St. Louis and helped and then became the director of Prisoner Family Services, which was primarily transportation. By the time I retired, we had facilitated more than 75,000 prison visits to every prison in Missouri. A monthly bus service from St. Louis, buses and vans. I've also been for 5 years a once-a-week volunteer chaplain at the St. Louis County Jail, and that was back in the late 70s, early 80s when the death penalty came in. So a lot of my clients, my colleagues, received the death penalty and others didn't, and they're still rotting in Missouri's prisons with life minimum 50 and then life no parole. And then the man who got me into that transportation program also soon convinced me and others that we should establish in St. Louis a ex-offender reentry program. And that became Project COPE, the acronym Congregation Offender Partnership Enterprise. We added the word enterprise because we thought COP was a really bad acronym.
Is that program still in existence?
It's changed its name and its mission somewhat. In fact, it's bigger.
And how's it going?
I'm worried about that it might have lost its soul. But that's I'm here and they're there, and so what do I know?
Ms. Hardin, could you please, Hetty, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, in 1990, I started a statewide organization of Missouri Cure, which stands for Citizens United for Rehabilitation of Errants, and it's part of a national organization that's in Washington, D.C., and has since gone international. Anyway, I'm the chair of Missouri Cure, which has been going for 27 years, and we have probably 700 or so prisoner members, plus prisoners' loved ones out in society and other concerned members of the community.
Okay, I got one question I'd like to, I probably would think both of you could jump in on and answer. What do you think, as a person that speaks for people in prison, what do you think the message to people out here in society should be? What is it that you most want them to know?
Well, they need to know a lot about what goes on in prison, because we're so isolated from the goings-on in prison out here, and that's a big part of the problem. There's no outside monitoring. Most people don't know anything about the prison system. And as far as CURE is concerned, our belief is that prison should be only for those who must be incarcerated, and that those in prison should have all the resources needed to turn their lives around. We believe prison should only be used for education and rehabilitation. So I would like to get more people on the outside to know what's going on in prison, more people in different organizations going into the prison, just a lot more interaction.
Okay, now, based on the meeting you had with the director last week, do you see any hope that some of the things that need to be corrected in the Department of Correction may be on the verge of change?
She spoke good things about people who have offended change, but how do we overcome the general fear that's in society? And I think there's a great misunderstanding about what crime looks like, because I lived in a very rough neighborhood for almost 30 years in my ministry in St. Louis. And our society is being fed fear, and that then causes us to do insane things with corrections.
I do have some hope. I know that change is not going to come overnight, but after hearing her vision, I believe that she's on the right track, and she has a desire to make changes. She wants to change the culture of the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board and prisons themselves. So I do have some hope.
I think that your point about the culture, absolutely right. It's what she says she dreams of doing. But having been involved in Missouri Corrections for almost 40 years, there's an awful lot of culture to overcome from violent wardens who did horrible things and weren't called to task for it by corrections. There's just so much that needs to be overcome. I guess my takeaway from our meeting last week is need to pray for that woman.
Yes, she has an awesome responsibility. Did she mention anything about trying to change the culture of the way people view people out in society, view people in prison?
Well, that's what I'm saying when I talk about fear. And I don't know that that's her task. I'm not sure how she can do it.
That's our task.
Yeah, I know
a big part of it is people like us have to make people on the outside aware of what's going on.
I know
I try to do that with our newsletter and going around to different groups. Keith and I are going to be speaking at a church Sunday in North County about the whole idea of the woman in our group whose church it is starting a ministry, and she feels that a lot of the people in her church who have loved ones in prison are ashamed to mention it, ashamed to have people know about it. So that's one of the things we're going to address.
I know that her precise predecessor, George Lombardi, did a lot of public speaking around the state, especially to civic organizations. And his theme was, you don't have to be so afraid of all these people. They're human beings. They've made mistakes. Almost every single one of them has deeply repented of what he did, because we locked him in jail for a while and he had time to think about it, or we punished him unnecessarily.
He or she.
And George worked hard at that. But again, it's so much more needs to be done to change public opinion.
Well, he could have been a good public relations person, but at least toward the end, I don't think he was a very good director.
Yeah, I'm afraid that might be true.
Well,
yeah.
We received an awful lot of complaints about some of the horrible things that were going on in prison during Mr. Lombardi's tenure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much effort he actually put in trying to make changes in the Department of Corrections. And I do recognize that it's a difficult task, even when you are at the top of the division or the department.
Yeah.
You know, because you have a lot of people in the Department of Corrections. They've been doing things a certain way for so long, and they've had these attitudes that they have for so long. It takes more than maybe we may be looking at maybe the next five or six different people to get appointed to that position to come in with that same agenda, trying to make these changes, because what we may be looking at is like all these old people that's in there and that's been doing things for so long. They may just have to die and they have to be replaced with somebody else. And I do recall hearing Ms. Precise say that she doesn't necessarily feel that people who have been in certain positions for so long are the best experts or the people that's best qualified to make certain type of decisions. And I think that's a refreshing new attitude that hasn't been promoted in Missouri for quite some time.
Right. And she said she's looking for people with the right skill sets, not just people with longevity in a department. So I do think she's got a lot of fresh ideas, and she apparently has been working on this when she was in North Carolina, and she's going to be working with the Justice Initiative, the Department of Justice, which is working with several prisons throughout the country, and is funded by the Pew Charitable Organization. So I think that's a real hopeful sign.
And when we have to deal with the issue of trying to change the culture of people, the way they view people in prison, we have a lot of horrible things that are being done to people out here on the street. It's not just in prison. And, you know, if people think that they can continue to get away with doing the people that's responsible for upholding the law think they can get away with doing the things that they're doing to people on the street, I don't see where we have a lot of hope of trying to change the way people feel about people in prison, because a lot of folks have this attitude, look, they've been tried and found guilty. It's been proven that they've committed crimes.
Well, the reverse is also true. A lot of things that, the horrible things that started in prison are now being done out on the street to people. I did want to mention, I read in the paper a while back that she's making a lot of changes in the St. Louis Community Relief Center downtown. She's brightening up, you know, painting the walls and making classrooms out of certain wings and trying to really change the whole atmosphere there. And she did say that she would do things in the prisons to brighten up the surroundings, and that she wants prisoners to be able to contribute to their community in prison and develop themselves in preparation to return to society where they can be contributing members. She said she believes in holding people accountable, but also rewarding good behavior.
Well, one of the things that worries me, I mean, we know that we've got far too many people in prison.
34,000, she said.
And a lot of these people at some point are going to have to be returned to society. Now, these politicians, they can make all the tough talk that they want to about being tough on crime. But the reality is that we have to start demanding better treatment for people who are in prison, because we want to try to ensure that once they come out here, they don't have an attitude, haven't been so mentally deranged that they want to come out in society and take the things out on innocent people that have been done to them as a matter of revenge. But there's another issue that concerns me. People always talk about rehabilitating people and returning them to society. What about the people who are already in prison who have received sentences that pretty much indicate they're never going to be back out in society? What do we do with these people? And that number is increasing exponentially.
And that statistic does not encourage prison staff who are face-to-face on the yard with the inmates to respect those inmates, those residents. I have seen so many examples of this, and I hear of it. I'm in contact with quite a number of people yet in prison, even though I retired 11 years ago. Lack of respect is just enormous, and that's part of the culture that needs to be overcome. And if we're having it, and we are having in Missouri a hard time staffing our prisons on the yard with correctional officers, we've reached down as low as 19-year-olds to become staff. That's absurd, I think. They just don't have the maturity to handle that. And they will quickly pick up the existing culture and will be able to do nothing about changing it. And they'll become part of the problem like others on the yard who don't know that a person who made a mistake is still a human being to be respected and helped toward rehabilitation and helped toward release.
And one of the scary things is that it's the people that they, or what they call on the front line, which is the lower level staff members, who basically have all the authority.
Oh, too much power.
You know, and in the previous administrations, the top echelon of the prison security and other officials, they are told that, you know, you just do your paperwork. You sit behind the desk, or, you know, you come in when you are called, but you let the guards out here on the yard. I mean, if you're talking about somebody that's 19 years old, how does he know how to deal with a person that's 20 or 30 years older than him, and he's been locked up in prison all these years and may not even have a chance of ever getting out? What can he say? What can he do? And naturally, the only thing that he can do is he has to resort to trying to pull rank.
You bet.
And that don't work on everybody.
Right.
You know, how do you rehabilitate somebody in the first place who's already been told you're never going to get out of prison? Why would I? What incentive would I have to want to be rehabilitated?
Amen.
You know, it's too much. There's too many problems for one person to change the whole culture, but at least she's trying and she's making a start, and I'm encouraged by it. She believes that she stresses a new philosophy on how corrections work. That people in prison should be treated the same, whether they're staff or prisoners. And she said she's got a lot of work to do with staff, and she already had a meeting with all the upper level staff,
wardens and assistants.
Yeah. And she said that's the first time in the history of the Missouri DOC that's ever been done.
Oh my!
And she said that next she's going to work on middle management. So again, it's a lot to take on, but I think that she's about the best bet we have to do it.
Well, as I stated earlier, I certainly welcome, you know, her new philosophy, because it's long overdue, and what they've been doing in the past, it hasn't been working. Everybody's admitting to that, but I think what we have is that we got a lot of people, their minds are not open to change, you know, and if people in society don't start pressuring people and standing behind folks like Ms. Precife, then these people, they're just going to drive this bus all the way over the cliff. And we, you know, it's just they don't have a solution. So the only thing they can do is just keep doing things the way they've been doing it. That's not good for society. It's not good for the people who are incarcerated, and it's not good for the staff members who have to man these institutions.
So, you know, she also brought with her another woman, Alana Boyles, who's the new director of adult institutions. And she seemed like she has some fresh ideas as well. So I just wish them both luck, and I hope that we can in some way work with them to make another perspective scene and to actually help make some changes.
Now, I recall that at the meeting, we pretty much came to the conclusion that, you know, there were a lot of issues that needed to be dealt with. So basically what we were concerned with, we didn't want to overburden her, and we narrowed the issues down that we want to deal with to just prison medical issues and parole policies. Can either one of you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I raised the issue of medical care because I have, in all of my years, I dealt with thousands of families with loved ones in prison, folks from St. Louis during all those years. And I know horror stories. People who died who shouldn't have died. People who didn't get care, period. When you're contracting with a medical care provider, so-called medical care provider, and they're doing it for profit. You know, I remember back when the department ran its own health system, and I knew some of the doctors. Now, the prison was only about one-sixth as big as it is now, the system.
What did you think of the health care then?
Well, because I knew some of them, I really felt quite optimistic, although I'm more informed now than I used to be, and so the horror stories I've heard make me wonder whether the department recognizes, and here's the philosophy that I have over the years. If we know that people coming into prison, and you heard me say this Wednesday, but I have more to add to it, if you know that on average people coming into prison have poorer health than the general population of the United States, when I said that, she and Ms. Boyles responded, seeming to suggest, don't you see what a hopeless task we have?
Yes.
And my thing is, don't you realize what a marvelous opportunity you have? Because here they are, they're locked up, and they're in crappy health, and you have a chance to, A, help them gain better health, but also to teach them the disciplines and, you know, and help them to know what good health really looks like and what good health care should look like by modeling it. And instead, we're modeling poor medical care provision.
Exactly. Now, Hedy, we only have a few minutes left. Could you elaborate on the situation with the parole board and what was your take on that?
Mary Ann McGivern brought out four problems, and those were problems of the parole board composition, that all of them are state legislators and law enforcement, problems of the lack of oversight of individual board members, which was evidenced with the revealing of the games they were playing at parole hearings. Third was the problem that parole is so frequently denied in the past 8 years that the prison population has risen in part because of the denials. And fourth, that prisoners frequently don't know why they're denied or what to do to receive a parole date. And I think, Keith, you mentioned the fact that people get boilerplate rejections. Mm-hmm. They just say it's because of the seriousness of the crime, which can never change. Mm-hmm. They may have been there 20, 30 years, and they're still saying the same old thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm aware that in Wisconsin, I think it was in 2015, they noted that the parole board got so strict that they went from like 1,400 paroles in 1 year down to less than 200 the next year. Now that's absurd.
And one of the problems that we also have in the parole board is that they keep recycling the same people over and over again. They keep sending them, they moving them around in different positions, but they still calling shots about who gets out on parole and who doesn't.
And a lot of the people that are appointed, it's just cronyism.
Oh.
You know, it's just who you know, and the governor was doing a favor for somebody, and it's not based on skill sets and, you know, people that know what's going on. One ex-prisoner who was there said that there should be at least one, preferably two, former prisoners on the parole board. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as long as we're talking about what really is needed, I agree with that.
Well, I don't know how we would be able to get around that because of the restrictions on confidentiality in the law, but I would think that maybe somewhere along the lines in the future we could get somebody there, and maybe not former prisoners, but somebody would be more open and understanding towards the situation. You know, people that come from a background where they know what breeds crime and what causes crime.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that you have to understand, what keeps you away from repeating the same mistakes that you've already made.
Mm-hmm. We have the opportunity as citizens to nominate people for the parole board, and also to, among our acquaintances, recruit. And then, having done that and gotten their name on the governor's list, we really need to do some politicking with legislators as well as the governor's office and scream and say, you've been appointing the wrong kind of people to this board. Here are some good chances to make it right.
Well, we're almost out of time. Perhaps in the near future, we'll have an opportunity to continue this conversation. Maybe it may afford us another opportunity to have the meeting with the director and come back and report on how well the progress that she's making is going. I certainly want to thank all of you, both of you, for being here on the show today. And let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that some of the things that we heard at the meeting last week will actually materialize. Thank you very much.
Okay, I agree.
Now, the calendar for July 17th. The Kansas City Public Library and the League of Women Voters will host an informational session to discuss the new voter identification law in Missouri. The topics to be covered will include what kind of ID will be accepted at the polls, how to get an ID if you don't have one, and how to vote absentee or provisional ballot. This session will be held Tuesday, July 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza Branch Library, 4801 Main Street, KCMO. Applications for Camp Choice are being accepted until August 11th for youth 12 to 14 years of age. Camp Choice provides youth with life enrichment experiences to help them make conscious choices that benefit their present and future spiritual, physical, educational, and social well-being. To apply for this September 8th to 10th retreat, get information on cost and financial assistance. Contact Janae Relaford Davis at 816-560-0977 or by email at campchoiceworldwide@yahoo.com or check out their website, campchoicekc.com. Corey's Network and the Chuck E. Cheese at 18701 East 39th Street, Independence, Missouri, are once again teaming up to help victims of murder. On Friday, July 21st, from 3 to 9 p.m., 15% of all purchases at the register, including food, merchandise, and token deals, will go to a reward fund for anyone having information about who murdered two young boys, Montel Ross and Jaden Ugwa. You are invited to help out this good cause and enjoy food, fun, and games. If you have information, call the TIPS hotline at 816-474-TIPS. That's 474-8477. Tune in next week when host David Bell talks with Dr. Michael Taylor about how his son was sent to prison for child porn that was uploaded to his computer without his knowledge. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, for sitting in for Beth Pike. Up next is Allie Catherine Bush and her guest, Michael Liamata.
Today is July 17th, 2017, and I am your host today, Allie Catherine Bush, with the Jaws of Justice program. Today, I am interviewing Michael Liamata. He is the executive director of Footprints Incorporated, and he is going to speak to us about the services that they have in the downtown, well, not really downtown, but for the community and inner city area. So good morning, Michael. This is your second interview with me, and we'll talk more about the first one later on, but welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you today and great to be back home in Kansas City.
All right. I understand that you did work in Washington, D.C. in the Obama administration with a program there. And after that ended, you came back to Kansas City and was appointed as CEO for Footprints. Could you tell us about how this organization works with people that have addictions?
So when I came back to Kansas City from D.C., you know, I had a number of interviews, but one day I was sort of thinking, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I was talking with my wife, and she said, well, I know what God wants you to do, and that's Footprints. I'd been a board member and actually helped to start the organization back in 2001. was a good friend of a man whose name is Wayne White.
Yes.
Wayne was a Vietnam veteran and had a career in corporate America until addiction kind of set him down a different track. And after he recovered, he had a real passion to help other people. So he started Footprints Ministry, Alcoholics Victorious, at several churches in the area. Eventually opened what he called the Life Change Station at 45th and Troost. And then one of the last things he did before he passed away in 2012 from effects of Agent Orange,
right,
was to begin a Veterans Administration short-term residence for homeless veterans. So today, Footprint still operates that VA-sponsored shelter, and we are working now to reopen the center at 45th and Troost.
Okay, could you tell us how you interact with your clients or the people that have these addictions?
Sure. So for the veterans program, we work as part of the Healthcare for the Homeless Veterans program with the Veterans Administration. So in that situation, all of the people who come to stay with us are referred by the VA. They contact the Homeless Initiative there, and then they are assigned caseworkers and social workers, and VA provides all the services. We are at 35th in Michigan, which is the 35 bus goes all the way to the VA, so it makes it a really nice location for us.
Okay.
Our whole purpose with that home is to give veterans a safe, home-like environment who have been homeless, but also through case management and other assistance, we work to help them become permanently housed. So last year, about 72 men who came through our program found permanent housing, which is about 90% success rate with working to put them in permanent housing. But one of the visions of the board has been, when Wayne passed away, he was a very big personality and had a lot of influence in the recovery community. But we couldn't find a good person to take kind of his role over, so we focused on really making the veterans program the best way, best possible program we could. So that was kind of put on hold. Now that I'm back and working with Footprints, our whole idea is to reopen the center at 45th and Troost, and we're calling it a recovery community center.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole focus is a place where people can come, find a safe environment, you know, look for help, maybe they're struggling with their sobriety or wanting to explore maybe options for themselves as to what they can do to, make a better life for themselves. And just this week, we opened a computer learning center. So we're working with people in recovery, folks who are in recovery homes, reentry houses, treatment centers, to provide for them class sessions that will help them learn computer skills from basic keyboarding all the way through Microsoft PowerPoint.
All right. Okay, that fits in with the first interview that I did with you when you were involved with Connecting for Good. And would you tell us a little bit about that, of how it helps people that need to go online and do digital?
Right. So I actually have been involved for the last 20 years pretty much with higher education. But when Google Fiber came to town in 2011,
mm-hmm.
Some colleagues and I recognized that their approach to reaching the inner city was not going to have a very big impact. So we formed the community organization Connecting for Good. One of our first things we did in 2012 was bring free Wi-Fi to the Rosedale Ridge housing community, and then have done some other Wi-Fi installations. We started by refurbishing computers in Rick Dean's garage. Rick is the co-founder of Connecting for Good and still with the organization. And then we began teaching people how to use the computer. So since its inception in 2011, over 10,000 people from the urban core have learned how to use the internet, email, web browsing. And I just found out recently that Connecting for Good, under its new leader, Tom Eiselman, expects to train about 7,000 people in this current year. So it's it's grown. I'm excited how it's been embraced by the community. And after I left to go to work for HUD, the board chose Tom as a leader, and he's done a very great job.
Okay. Now, with Footprints, you have several board members. Could you tell us a little bit about what each one of them do?
Well, the Faye Kendrick Johnson is our Johnson Kendrick is our board president, and she's been involved for some time with Christian Fellowship Baptist Church. That was the building we work out of, and she has a ministry called Dave's Place. Right now, she is working with another staff person that we have to open a women's transitional home down at 74th in Brooklyn, which we hope was going to be available here later this fall. You know, Kansas City, like so many other metropolitan areas, is experiencing this whole epidemic of opioid addiction.
Right.
We know that in the past 5 years, death from opioids has doubled or tripled. And it's really interesting that in the age group 50 to 65, the death rate from opioid overdose has gone up like 165%. It's interesting to think about the fact that 90% of all opioids are prescribed in the United States, which is, you know, the world uses only 10% of it. We use 90% of it. I think we've got this whole culture, you know, that's so pain avoidance, and doctors who aren't necessarily educated in, you know, what happens to people when they're overprescribed. Something like 10 to 15% of people who use opioids for more than 2 or 3 months actually become addicted to it.
Okay. Do you think that with this new administration and with Trump that they are allotting enough money to combat opioids? I hear that it's around $45 billion. Do you think that even scratches the surface? Or?
Yeah, and I think the jury's out on all of that, whether that money will actually be allocated. And I think there's a huge question mark about whether we are going to have the resources we need to fight this epidemic right now. And one of the things that I have to say, though, and this even goes back to the time when Wayne White led Footprints, is that he had a lot of influence on some policy at the state level with the Department of Mental Health, and even nationally with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration in D.C. In terms of kind of a looking at drug treatment in a new way, and that is not just looking at treatment being something that'd be a hospitalization, and but looking at recovery as a lifestyle and a long-term proposition. And, you know, I ran a treatment center in Michigan back in the 80s, and I'm sort of coming back into the field again 30 years later, and there's been a number of changes, and many of them I'd say I'm pretty happy with. The first is that there's been a lot more acceptance in the mental health field of addiction and recovery. As a matter of fact, you know, the term that's becoming more prominent in those circles is something called substance use disorder. Which has kind of removed the shame from the notion of addiction. I think the other thing that I'm seeing is a more of a recognition and acceptance as far as the role of peers. Missouri is one of the nation's leaders. I think Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Missouri are considered by SAMHSA to be top states in the country leading the recovery movement. And so this whole Missouri Recovery Support Specialist credential is received by people who have been in recovery themselves, take 45 hours of training, have some substantial volunteer experience, and can be recommended by a professional substance abuse counselor. And that's sort of a paraprofessional credential that's gaining some great acceptance. With our computer lab, even that where we're teaching digital skills, the people that we that are doing the teaching are in recovery themselves, and one of them has already completed the training to become the recovery support specialist. So they're kind of people who know the digital skills, but also who know the addiction part of it.
Right.
So that when we work with people coming out of that background, there's kind of a special understanding.
Okay, Michael, I want to mention too that you have a degree from the university. What is that one?
Mid-American Nazarene University.
Yes, you are a reverend.
Right.
Liamita. So tell us a little bit about how that prepares people with their religious point of view about being addicted.
Well, it's an interesting journey that I've had. I actually was a hippie back in the 70s and Jesus freak, if you remember the movement where a lot of people that came from that lifestyle to become Christians. But I ended up at a very conservative Lutheran church in Michigan, and then went on to get a degree from the Lutheran Seminary in Minneapolis. And I worked for many years both as a treatment director and director of education for a group called the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions. And City Union Mission, Kansas City and City Union Mission and Kansas City Rescue Mission here in Kansas City, along with 300 other similar organizations, are part of that mission association. And then I did get my actually degree from Mid-American Nazarene in organizational administration. So I've been kind of an organization builder, but I think for me, my faith in Christ, the fact that he rescued me from a very destructive lifestyle, have always sort of been my my focus in life and my mission. I've been involved for a long time with 12-step groups. And I always feel that, maybe my own experience of being, rescued it allows me to speak with other people and to, relate to them more.
Okay, now when people get into the mindset that, once a drunk, always a drunk, I think that their spirituality really comes into focus on how they should feel about overcoming these addictions.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that we want to try to do through Footprints and has been actually part of the recovery movement is to take some of the shame away from having a struggle with alcohol and drugs. Everybody has a struggle with something, and I don't know why we've sort of made alcohol and drugs, one thing that's so shameful. And of course, we do get in when we become addicted, we do end up doing shameful things. We lie, we cheat, we steal, et cetera, et cetera. But, as people, we're not all that different. And I think we've always said that addiction is kind of like the great leveler. And in 12-step meetings, you could find bankers and college professors and homeless people. Because, a lot of us have different support systems. A lot of us have different family relationships that keep us from ending up on the streets. But I think when you say once a drunk, always a drunk, I think we have to be careful, because even though, you may have the disease of substance use disorder, you don't have to always be a drunk. There's a way to be abstinent, and that's what we call recovery. And that is, you will never be able to drink again like a normal person. And the best approach is not to drink at all. So, there are people that are proponents of, going from, addiction to, being a moderate drinker. Well, that's not happening. A lot of people say, how do you turn a pickle back into a cucumber? Well, you just don't. And in the same way, I know myself, because of my own experience, that my safest approach to living a healthy, normal life is not to drink at all.
Right.
And I'm thankful to God that this October, it will be 33 years for me that I've been sober.
That is wonderful. Okay, Michael, for the people just tuning in now to the show, would you give them information again on where you're located and how they can reach you if they need your help?
Great. Yeah, so the Footprints Outreach Center is on 4501 Troost, that's 45th and Troost, and we will be having an event coming up on August 10th, that's a Thursday, from 4 to 6, where it will be a reopening of the what we're going to call the Wayne D. White Recovery Community Center.
Okay.
So we're going to celebrate his life and dedicate the facility to him.
All right.
He's been a great leader in the church world, in the recovery world, and so that'll be part of our event. It's going to be a kickoff. And the whole notion of a recovery community center, I like to call it, is kind of a drop-in center on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just a place to hang out and visit with other people in recovery, but we have 12-step meetings actually 7 days a week in the facility. We have the only 2 o'clock Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the city from every day except Sunday. Mm-hmm. Cocaine Anonymous meets in the building. Al-Anon meets in the building. Alcoholics Victorious, which is a Christian program, meets in the building. We also have a computer learning center where we're going to be teaching basic computer skills, job search skills, career development. And right now we're just putting together a curriculum. It's a 14-week program
mm-hmm.
for people who want to recover from alcohol and drugs. That's going to deal a lot with issues of family, relapse, and do some counseling and one-on-one support. We're really grateful that we received some support this year from Combat
okay.
that we'll be using to support our programs there.
Okay, is there a phone number?
Yes, I'm sorry. The phone number mm-hmm. is 816-561-0567.
And for people that can get online, what is the website where they can learn more about your background, what your dedication is to this type of work?
Great, yes. Yeah, so the website is just kcfootprints.org,
mm-hmm.
kcfootprints.org.
Okay. All right. I'd like to mention with you some of the awards that you have received for your dedication in the community. Could you touch on what some of those awards are?
Well, we've worked, I think one of the awards that I'm so happy with as far as the time with Connecting for Good is the NARA Awards, which is the National Association of Housing Redevelopment Officials. It's working with public housing. And so while we were with Connecting for Good, mm-hmm. we did work to, we were recognized by both the Southwest and the Kansas NARA affiliates for our work at Juniper Gardens. Juniper Gardens is a housing development run by the Kansas City, Kansas Housing Authority,
okay.
which we installed Wi-Fi that reaches most of the community there for mm-hmm. free. And then in the community there was a tavern that was really a kind of a headache for the people that ran Juniper Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
It was at, and so they actually bought out the building before it became another tavern.
Okay.
We approached them about using the building for Connecting for Good.
Right.
And so now it was our headquarters in Kansas, where it has 25 seat open computer lab that serves the children of the Juniper Gardens in the afternoons, as well as Connecting for Good computer refurbishing. One of the things that I feel really good about is a group called the Net Institute gave me an award, which they call the Recovery Heroes. They worked with a lot of people in the Christian community and even people in the overseas mission world around addiction. And because of my work with recovery, with AGRM and with the Addiction Studies Program of City Vision University, they gave me that award, which is, I felt, a real honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know that you have volunteers that help you with your programs. Is there a way that you measure the success of what's going on with the people that have contacted you?
Well, it's interesting because we really are kind of reinstituting the recovery element of Footprints.
Mm-hmm.
It was on hold for the last 5 years, and we focused on working with the veterans.
Okay.
I think probably with our veterans work, the number that means the most to me is the fact that we have actually found permanent housing for 90% of the men who have stayed with us. it's, you know, at the goal for the Veterans Administration is 45%, and we're getting about twice that. And I think it's because it's a very home-like atmosphere. We have 24/7 staffing, and people really get a chance to take the time. The stay is usually from 3 to 6 months to assess their options, decide what they want to do. And we've just had a lot of great rapport with people, spent a lot of time. We only have 10 men at a time in the house, mm-hmm. so it's a very good staffing ratio. As we move forward with doing the counseling groups, the classes, the one-on-one, we will know a lot more about impact. I know, you know, it's been a very successful program in the past, and we're looking for something very similar. Mm-hmm. We you know, will be licensed by the State Department of Mental Health as a recovery support center. The counselors that work at Footprints have all been credentialed by the Missouri Credentialing Board as substance abuse counselors. So we have professionals that will be available, and services that will be free to some people because of their, you know, economic situation, which is, there's just not enough help out there, so we're glad to be able to offer that. We do know that through the support groups, the 12-step groups that meet in the facility currently, we're reaching well over 300 people in the community every week.
Okay. Is the Veterans Administration the main source of funding, or?
Yes, for the veterans work, that's 100% supported by the VA. There are other opportunities for that we're looking for, and some help that we've received, like I said, through combat, mm-hmm. through foundation grants. The state of Missouri has the Access to Recovery Program. These are all things that we will be tapping into to support the efforts at the Truth Outreach Center.
Okay, and do you accept donations?
Oh, yes, we definitely do. one of the things that has been really helpful for us is that the people who, in our rehousing of veterans, we go through a lot of furniture. You know, when we take a homeless veteran, and or I would say formerly homeless veteran, mm-hmm. and giving him a chance to move into permanent housing, we help to supply furniture. We sometimes provide clothing. We often provide housewares, pots and pans, dishes, all of that to someone that's been, you know, not having their own residence for a long time. But also, we do need a lot of help. We've invested quite a bit of money and time and effort into the building at 45th and Troost. So we will be, we have used help in painting and cleaning and a whole lot of other things. Mm-hmm. I'm excited now that we've been working with AARP and have actually gotten a couple of workers through AARP to help us as staffing our phone and reception desk and computer lab.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, for the listeners that have just tuned in, I am Allie Catherine Bush, and I am the host today with Jaws of Justice Program 90.1 FM Community Radio. I'm interviewing Michael Laimita, Reverend Laimita.
Uh-huh. It's the 420 Drug War News.
I'm Gretchen Burns Bergman, and I'm the co-founder, executive director of A New Path, which stands for Parents for Addiction Treatment and Healing. And I'm the lead organizer of our national, now international, Moms United to End the War on Drugs campaign. A New Path works to reduce the stigma associated with addictive illness, and we advocate for therapeutic rather than punitive drug policies, and the larger campaign, Moms United campaign, works to end the criminalization, stigmatization of people who use drugs and people who struggle with substance use disorders, and to end the mass arrests and incarceration and the accidental overdose deaths and the border violence and drug war violence that's all a part and parcel of a very misguided and destructive almost 50-year war on drugs.
It's just not working, is it?
It hasn't been working for years, and you think about the loss of lives over these years, not to mention the loss of liberties, but it's beyond tragic. You know, I feel like so many of these issues are interrelated. At the beginning of the year, we started a campaign, hashtag Moms Resolutions, that really talked about the intersection of the war on drugs, how it ties in with racism and the war on women and the war on LGBTQ and the war on immigrants and on and on. And to feel now that we are going backwards and having to resist and defend the positions that the successes that we have had over the years in terms of therapeutic, compassionate, and much better informed drug policy is very hard for us. We're a parent-driven advocacy organization. I mean, our whole point is to try to make the world a better place for our children and to fight for their lives and their liberties, and to feel that once again we have to really dig in our heels and defend what we have accomplished so far, rather than continuing to move forward and get better drug policy, you know, and human policy, let's say human rights. Health care for substance use disorders, it has been dismally small to begin with. So now you're looking at cutting in the midst of a crisis, as you say. The numbers continue to go up at such an alarming rate of overdoses in the United States. And we're losing our sons and daughters.
We'll have part two tomorrow, DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
We hope that you have enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. This is Jeff Humfeld. And our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesdays, Alternative Radio on Wednesdays, a mix of national and local programming on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Dr. Mike's Morning Medicine Show, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio at 6 p.m.